And yes, I am the coach, Butch McAdams, and you're listening to another edition of your show, the sports show of the DMV, In and Out of Sports. In and Out of Sports is sponsored in part by our great friends at Horton's Funeral Service for over 80 years, simply the very best in family funeral care. They're true to their mission statement, which is service with dignity at any cost. Write the number down, 202-829-9000. Also, the historic 19th Street Baptist Church, the DMV AIA. Visit us at dmvaia.org under the leadership of our president. He is Lloyd Mays. And the Bethesda Blues and Jazz Supper Club. Check them out, 240-330-4500. They're located in the heart of downtown Bethesda, and that's Wisconsin Avenue, 7719. The Power Trust, joyful signing, Tacoma Station, Martin's Caterers, Fresh Communities Farm, a Brandywine, and Rev Nation. Well, folks, this morning, if you are a fan of the local team, and I know it's been tough the last 20-plus years, but if you go back before then and now, I got a feeling that it's going to get a lot better. And a lot of folks, as yours truly, who just couldn't take anymore, we're coming back. And I'm talking about the Washington football team. Well, this morning, our guest, I cannot think of a better authority on the history of the Washington, quote-unquote, Redskins, the Washington football team, or the Washington Commanders. And he has authored four books. The author of the Washington, quote, Redskins football vote. The author of George Allen, A Football Life. The author of Joe Gibbs, An Enduring Legacy, and the author of, quote, Redskins Encyclopedia. Without further ado, let's bring on Mike Richmond. Mike, good morning. Welcome to In and Out of Sports, and man, I can't wait to chop it up with you.
I look forward to it as well, Coach, and thank you very much for having me on. Yeah, we have a lot to discuss this morning.
Yes, let's get it done. I guess the first obvious question, talk about the beginning, the origin of your interest and passion for the burgundy and gold.
I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I became really attached to the team. Like in the 60s, I was too young to remember a whole lot, but when George Allen came here in 1971, I was 10 years old, and I just became hooked. I mean, I was starting to develop a real interest in professional sports, sports of all kinds, for that matter, the major sports. And so then when he came here in 71 and pulled off a 9-4-1 season for the Redskins that year and their first playoff appearance in a quarter century, I mean, I just became hooked on the team. And I lived vicariously through him, through other several other players on the team who I followed closely, Billy Kilmer, Sonny Jurgensen, Larry Brown, Ken Houston, those guys, Brig Owens. I just love those players, and it just kind of multiplied from there. My interest, of course, soared through that era, and then we had the Joe Gibbs era that followed, and just one thing led to another. And I so happened to choose journalism as a career. So I parlayed it into writing the books that you mentioned.
And let's start talking about the history of the burgundy and gold. They originally were in Boston. Is that correct?
That's right. Their very first season of existence, 1932, they were in Boston, and they were known as the Boston Braves.
That's
that
right.
Was their first beer.
Mm-hmm. And then
no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Please continue.
So then it was the next season. They became the Redskins. They were renamed the Redskins. They were forced to move across town to Fenway Park. They originally played there in their first season. They played at Braves Field, Boston University, but there was a problem with the lease there, and so they had to move to another stadium. So they chose Fenway Park, and the owner at the time, George Preston Marshall, wanted to create a connection with the Red Sox, so he chose red, and he also wanted to maintain the Native American theme that he had with the Braves, so he ended up with Redskins. There's another part to that story, actually, that Marshall had an affinity toward Native Americans. He had a fascination toward them, and there was a movie that he really liked. He was very close with Hollywood, by the way, and there was a movie that he really liked and appreciated called Redskin. It was a silent movie in 1929, and it was very sympathetic toward the plight of Native Americans at the time. So that is part of the story as well as to why he chose the name Redskins.
Now, you and I have had conversation on this. As I stated, under the leadership of our founder, Miss Kathy Hughes, she originally banned the term Redskin. And other than a quote, I don't use it because I really believe that it's a racist term. Okay, that's debatable, but you told me a story and shared with our listeners this morning on the logo, which some people would look and say that was racist as well, but talk about the history of the logo.
Right. Well, the logo was created entering the 1972 season. And at the time, the Redskins had the R on the helmets, which was the vision of Vince Lombardi, which he never got to see because he passed away before the 1970 year. But he wanted to create that connection that he had, the logo that he had with the Packers. But so a Native American who was very familiar with Washington and who actually came to like the Washington Redskins, Walter Blackie Wetzel, who was actually president of the National Congress of American Indians and the chair of the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, he said he approached the Redskins prior to the 1972 season, and in particular George Allen, and he said he wanted to see a different logo on the helmet of the Redskins, something resembling more of a fighting, a courageous Native American. And so it was his vision, combined with the Redskins' consent to agree to a new logo, that led to they developed a composite led by Wetzel, and that's how we came up with the logo that existed for nearly 50 years until it was retired in 2020. But it was originally the vision of a famous Native American, Walter Blackie Wetzel, and it was a lot of people don't understand that, but it was. It was the creation of a Native American. So I never thought in any way that the logo itself was racist. I would never say that at all. And you touched on that as well.
Well, it's hard to say it's racist when it was created by a Native American. Now, that's not to say that all Native Americans would approve of it, but still, it's very difficult to label the logo racist because of it was created by a Native American. But let's talk about racism for a minute. And your research, what does it tell you about George Preston Marshall? Was his policy, was it his beliefs, or was it political / business? And what I mean by that was at the time, Washington was the southernmost team, okay, because you didn't have the Carolina teams. You didn't have Atlanta. You didn't have Miami. And Washington was it. And so their games, their broadcast network, and their support came from the South. And so I asked the question, either way, it was evil and it was despicable. But getting into it, does your research tell you that this was Marshall's beliefs, or was he just doing business?
What I found out is that I think, and this is coming from me, other people may have different perspectives, but a large part of that decision was business related. Now, I have not researched Marshall enough in depth to know any other aspect of his thinking toward this. Like, you could say he grew up in West Virginia. Okay, so I know stereotyping, that could tell you something, but in terms of his thinking toward people of color, but I quoted a former Redskin in my book, The Redskins Encyclopedia, about this, as well as maybe one or two other people, that the team being the team of the South really influenced Marshall mostly from a business perspective to want to keep the team all white. He was playing to stereotypes of Southerners, because Southerners, they came to D.C. to see the Redskins play. Okay,
right.
So Marshall was playing to stereotypes. He thought he would alienate his Southern fan base. That is mostly what I gathered in terms of what influenced him in his decision making to keep the team all white over the years. But now I'm not dismissing the fact that there may have been other factors that influenced him as well. And like I said, I didn't research that part of him deeply enough, but it seemed to be a large business reasoning on his part to keep the team all white. And like you said, I mean, they were the southernmost NFL team, and not only did they have fans coming to see the team play, coming from the South, Southern cities, but and also, like you said, they had the radio network, this vast radio network that actually stretched all the way as far west as Texas. So and they played exhibition games in the South too. I remember Charlie Taylor telling me, Brig Owens, you know, how they played games in the South, and then they would be making appearances in those cities as well, autograph appearances in those cities too. So, but I mean, of course, this was after the integration. But in answer to your original question, I think it was largely a business reason on his part that influenced him to keep the team all white.
And stay with us. We're going to take a short pause, but on the other side, I want to ask, how much did this set this team back? Because when you look at what was occurring in the 50s and in the 60s, where you would have integrated teams like the Baltimore Colts, like the New York Giants, like the Cleveland Browns, and they would come to town and just run right through Washington. And in 1961/62, when Marshall was forced to integrate, I want to talk about that because a lot of people don't know the story behind that. So stay with us. We're talking all things burgundy and gold. And if you are a fan of the burgundy and gold or just a football fan, I know you will enjoy this. Our guest is Mike Richmond. More on the other side. We're talking the history of the burgundy and gold. We've got so much more to talk about, and the guy that's going to navigate us through, he is the renowned author. He is Mike Richmond. Mike, during the time when Washington was lily white, the other teams had integrated, and they were winning. Washington was, they were terrible. And I can remember at a very, very young age, Bobby Mitchell, Jim Brown, for the Cleveland Browns, Lenny Moore, Johnny Sample for the Colts, and, you know, Roosevelt Grier, Roosevelt Brown for the Giants, and these teams would just consistently beat Washington. Talk about those lean years.
It was the Redskins were like a weekly doormat for many of the teams in the NFL, tops among them, like you mentioned, the, you know, Cleveland Browns, Giants, the Colts, for that matter. I remember Sam Huff telling me that they would see the Redskins on their schedule and they would look at them as a scrimmage to prepare for the team the following week. The Redskins were just really, really bad. I mean, I think a large part of that was Marshall's refusal to integrate the team. They just didn't have the talent to keep up with the rest of the NFL. I mean, between the end of World War II and when Allen arrived, the Redskins only had four winning seasons throughout that whole quarter century stretch. So it was just it was a depressing time to be a fan of the team. And there were reports that Marshall was even considering moving the team out of the city because the interest, I mean, when look, you know, I think there's a comparison to what has happened in recent years here, that the interest in the team was waning at the time. People just weren't going to the games and because they were losing so often. But yeah, they were they couldn't keep up with the rest of the league in terms of talent.
Now, my research, and you would know better, tells me that Marshall did not have an epiphany. He did not wake up and say, you know, I've been doing this wrong, I got to correct myself. But why he integrated, he was forced, from my research, when the newly built stadium, at the time was DC Stadium, was being built, I believe it was the Kennedy administration, Secretary Udall, basically said, if you don't integrate, you'll be playing your games on East Capitol Street, not in this new stadium.
East Capitol Street may be right. I know they definitely said, the Kennedy administration, that they were going to lose their lease to play at then DC Stadium. Yeah, if they didn't integrate the squad, right? He didn't have an epiphany. He didn't, you know, he just didn't just say to himself, "Oh, I've lost for the past so many years, and I think I'd better, you know, start signing some black players so we can gain some traction in the league." He didn't say that to himself. He was forced. The Kennedy administration said to him, "Yeah, if you want to play your games at the new stadium, you've got to integrate." And so that's how they ended up signing Bobby Mitchell. It was really they had the number one draft pick after the 61 season. The draft at the time was held toward the end of the regular season. So they had the number one draft pick toward the end of the 61 season, which would apply to 62. But Ernie Davis, the great running back out of Syracuse, another great running back that came from that school following Jim Brown, he did not want to play for the Redskins. He assumed the Redskins would draft him. He said, "I'm not going to play for that SOB Marshall." That was his quote. So the Redskins traded the rights to the number one pick to the Cleveland Browns. And in turn, the Browns dealt Bobby Mitchell and another running back, Leroy Jackson, to the Redskins. So that's how those two ended up here. And then there were others that ended up here too. The lineman John Nisby from the Steelers. Ron Hatcher, the Redskins drafted a running back out of Michigan State, Ron Hatcher. He was also black. So they had four black players who came starting in the 62 season, which is really, a lot of people think that Bobby Mitchell was the one and only black player who, you know, who integrated the squad at the time, but that wasn't really the case. They were four blacks. There was also a Latino player who came for the first time that year.
And do you recall his name?
I do not. He played for one or two seasons here. I don't remember his name offhand. But he also signed that year. But Mitchell, of course, was. It's correct to say, and I've actually when I explain this whole story, I say Bobby Mitchell, of course, was the first black superstar to play in this city. And the fans came to see him play. I mean, they were starting to fill the seats again. And he had a spectacular 1962 season. And then it just continued on from there. And, you know, later on in the 60s, I mean, the Redskins had one of the top offenses in the NFL, which you and I have discussed as well. They had a mediocre defense. They couldn't keep pace defensively, but offense, they had Sonny Jurgensen, quarterback, and some of the top receivers in the league, Charlie Taylor, Jerry Smith, tight end, Bobby Mitchell. And that one year, 1967, Jurgensen was number one in the league in passing, and Taylor was number one in receptions. Smith was two, and Mitchell was four. They just had such an explosive offense at the time. And actually, that's when the seats at DC Stadium really started filling, and they started selling out games. And that's that sellout streak that lasted for decades that has often been talked about regarding the franchise. That's when it started.
Can you imagine that trio of receivers and Sonny playing today under today's rules?
He'd be throwing for 5,000 yards a year. I mean, actually, you know, we talk about the Monk, Sanders, and Clark trio in 1980, or the late 80s and early 90s.
Posse.
That played here. I mean, these guys were just as good, if not better. I mean, they were. You had two future Hall of Famers in that receiving trio, and then of course Jurgensen was another Hall of Famer. You had three future Hall of Famers in that quartet. And I think you can even make the argument that Jerry Smith should seriously be considered for the Hall of Fame. I mean, back then, I mean, the passes that he was
tremendous.
Catching, the numbers he had back in the 60s were phenomenal. And I think he was one of the first great receiving tight ends in the league. But you could put Mike Ditka and John Mackey up there as well. But and he was undersized, too. But he was a great, great receiving tight end.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about some of the coaches post segregation. Talk about some of the coaches. I remember Otto Graham coming in, and we were excited that because Otto had the name, he was associated with winning championships with Cleveland. But how will history and your research dictate the level of success that Otto Graham had as a head coach here?
He was mediocre to bad. I mean, he had one, I guess, sort of memorable season. I think there was 7-7 in 1966. That was actually the year that they beat the Giants, 72-41. And the following year, I know they were sub 500. They were in the two ensuing seasons, the last 2 years here. He was not head coaching material in NFL, and he was gone after the 68 season, which is when Edward Bennett Williams, the Redskins team president at the time, running the daily operations, that's when he pursued Vince Lombardi, but. I don't think Sonny really appreciated Otto Graham that much. I don't think Sam Huff liked him too much. He just was not head coaching material here. So, he was a great, great player. Hall of Famer, certainly, as a player with the Cleveland Browns. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there have been many cases in NFL history where, you know, great players do not necessarily make great coaches.
Absolutely. And that's in NFL history, NBA history, MLB history across the board. We're going to take another commercial pause, but man, let's get into the George Allen era. And I love George Allen. George Allen was my favorite coach. Now, I didn't like Allen as much as general manager, but let's talk about George Allen. The future is now. And
that was his motto. The future is now. Absolutely. He wanted to win immediately. And that when he came here in 71, he proclaimed that the future is now, and he signed all of those so-called over-the-hill veterans, although not all of them were really
Hold that thought. We're going to take a break, and we'll definitely get into it. Hey, next up, we'll talk about the George Allen era. Three cheers for the Redskins. Hip, hip, hooray. Hip, hip, hooray. Hip, hip, hooray. That was George Allen. Stay with us. Let's go back to our newsmaker line. We've got author and historian. He is Mike Richmond. And Mike, the George Allen era. Ah, man, I was excited because this guy, he's a winner, at least for the first, at that point, it was 14 games. Now, after that, roll the dice. But talk about George Allen. What made him so special?
Number one, he was a perfectionist in terms of his attention to detail. He just, you know, we say, look at coaches today, and they have to really, really work hard. I mean, they have, it's almost like a 24/7 job. He was one of the first coaches in the NFL to devote that much time to coaching. I say one of the first. There were others as well, but he was a workaholic. He would try to outthink the opposing coaches. And, you know, his saying was, I will know you better than you know your own team. Of course, I mean, it's impossible, but that was the approach that he took. He was a pioneer in the NFL in terms of defense and special teams as well. Special teams were a big deal to him. And his special teams turned so many games around. So he would just outwork, outcoach players. And he had this sort of like Rolodex of players he could get if one went down with an injury. Case in point, after the 67 exhibition season, Rosie Greer went down with an injury, one of the fearsome foursome, and he got Brown. He got the great defensive lineman from the Detroit Lions, whose name escapes me right now.
Oh, you're talking. We'll see. It was Roger Brown.
He got Roger Brown.
Roger Brown.
Greer. Roger Brown like almost instantly from the Detroit Lions. So it just plugged a hole with the loss of Greer. And the Rams kept on winning. They won so big in 67, finished 11-1-2. So he had that knack about it. He knew how to be able to acquire players so quickly like that. And he did that on a number of occasions when the Redskins really needed players too. So I think one of the major ways I would answer your question is he was just a workaholic, and he would try to just outcoach his opposing coaches that way. But there were other ways too. I mean, he had those instincts about him. He was a very, very intelligent guy. And in terms of coaching and having those instincts and knowing how to take advantage of certain situations on the field, he also preached ball hawking. That was one of his big deals. And his teams created so many turnovers. But you mentioned it. You didn't really appreciate for him as a general manager, what he did as a GM. And there are a lot of people who question his methods over the year, like relying on so many veteran players. And you could look back and say that was a major reason why his teams in the 70s, the Redskins teams, they kind of plateaued after the 72 season when they went to Super Bowl VII. They still made the playoffs three times after that, but under Allen. But they weren't like a great, really great team. They certainly weren't on par with the Cowboys, and they weren't on par with the Pittsburgh Steelers of that era. So, but you could actually lay that at the feet of Allen for his continuous pursuit of veterans and not going after younger players, which is an argument that I I make in my latest book, George Allen, A Football Life, that's probably what led to his team's plateauing at that point, that he didn't really go after the younger players and like dare to be bad for one or two seasons and get those really higher draft picks. Like, I mean, you know, you cannot compare any drafts that Allen had to like the 74 Steelers draft with all those Hall of Famers they brought in.
Mm-hmm. I've got a question from the listeners. The question is, did Otto Graham trade Paul Krause while Edward Bennett Williams was out of the country?
He certainly traded Paul Krause. And I never heard the story that Edward Bennett Williams was out of the country at the time. But Edward Bennett Williams apparently had a hand in that trade. So I've never heard the story while that Edward Bennett Williams was out of the country at the time. Oh, and by the way, Allen tried to get Charlie, when Allen coached the LA Rams in the 60s, he tried to get Charlie Taylor from Edward Bennett Williams, knowing what Williams had done. And also what, you know, Williams having a hand in the Gary Beeben trade.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, Gary, yeah.
The Rams drafted Beeben, who was Allen knew that he couldn't play in the NFL. Beeben, the Heisman Trophy winner, quarterback from UCLA. Allen knew he couldn't play in the NFL. That was really a Dan Reeves pick, Reeves being the owner of the LA Rams at the time. But Allen orchestrated a trade to the Redskins. And they got a couple of good draft picks out of that trade. But Williams had a hand in that.
And then George Allen, let's go back to the beginning where he was Buddy Ryan long before Buddy Ryan, meaning a defensive genius that won a championship for the Bears and was carried off the field after that game against the Giants when the head coach, George Halas, was not carried off. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It was a assistant coach, George Allen, who was carried off the field after that game, because the players really knew that it was Allen that won the championship for them. I mean, his defensive coaching, I mean, that was an incredible Bears defense, that 63 defense. They allowed a league low 114 points, and 144 points, and they had many other league highs on the defensive side of the ball. They were just a great, great defense, and you could absolutely compare them to the 85 Bears defense, the Wilbur Marshall being one of the great players on that defense, later a Redskin. But there are distinct comparisons between those two defenses. But Allen was the coach carried off the field after that game, and he was also honored in the locker room after that game. The players threw him the game ball, and they sang that that song, Hooray for George, You're a Horse's Ass.
That's fair, yeah.
That song had originally been conceived several years before by another Bear player from a previous era, but they sang that song in the locker room. That song did not originate when Allen was with the Redskins, but they picked it up. But they sang the song too. And part of the story is that Halas was kind of jealous about, you know, all the attention that Allen was getting with that win, but the players solely credit George Allen for their ability to win the championship that season. Ed Obradovich, I mean, he leaves no doubt that it was George Allen. Ed Obradovich, the really good defensive tackle for the Bears in that era, he leaves no doubt that it was Allen that led them to winning a championship that year.
And it was so ironic, again, if you look back 1963 and then you fast forward to 85, and it's a very similar situation with Mike Ditka as the head coach and Buddy Ryan as the assistant coach.
Oh, absolutely, yes. But the difference, though, is both of them were carried off the field.
That's right.
After winning the Super Bowl. I mean, it's a subtle point, but an assistant in Ryan was carried off, too. But there are all of those comparisons between the 63 Bears and the 85 Bears, both just tremendous defenses. And there's also the comparison that after that, after those seasons, you could say that both teams start to slip in the in their records in the ensuing years. I mean, the Bears did make the playoffs for definitely 86 and 87, and losing to the Redskins, by the way, both years. But the Bears did not make the playoffs after winning the 63 championship. They really, really had like a precipitous fall in the like 66, 67 seasons. They and onward, they just had some really, really bad years. And actually, one of the like major reason for the fall, and you can the players from that era will say this as well, is that Halas did not hire George Allen as the head coach. Like Obradovich told me that after that 63 championship season, Halas just sort of gone off into the sunset and given the coaching reins to Allen. It was George Allen's turn, but Halas refused to. He was stubborn, and then later he took George Allen to court when Allen wanted to sign as head coach with the Los Angeles Rams prior to the 66 season.
Mm-hmm. And boy, I tell you, we've got some great listeners. Another friend listener texted me and said that the Mexican-American was Ed Seance, and from 1946 to 1951, played halfback and kick returner for Washington, and also all-pro defensive lineman Gene Brito, Spanish.
Brito,
and,
right.
Yep, and right. Spanish and Mexican-American heritage. So, yeah, that was it. But
I was thinking, I do want to say that I looked up that player, and I shouldn't have said that or implied that he was the first Latino to be signed, but Angelo Coya was the player I was thinking
Angelo
of.
Angelo Coya, yeah. Yep, Angie Coya. Yep, I remember he was a wide receiver. I thought he was Italian, okay, and when you had mentioned, I was going to say Angelo Coya. I believe he was number 48, I believe, but just tremendous compliment to Bobby Mitchell. Well, let's stay with us. We're going to have some more talk, George Allen and the upcoming book. And then, of course, we got to segue into the glory days of what? 4 Super Bowls in 9 years and 5 NFC title games in 9 years. Did we realize how good we had it as Washington sports fans back then? I don't know. I know now, but then we were kind of spoiled. Stay with us. Speaking of being spoiled, hey, I know you love this, and you've got more from Mike Richmond. Let's go back to our Newsmaker line. Great stuff, great history, information from Mike Richmond. And Mike, Allen leaves, and then we have, what was it, Jack Pardee takes over.
Right.
Right. Talk about Pardee, and then Joe Gibbs. But before then, I think the most important hiring was Bobby Bethard.
Right. Well, Bobby Bethard was the GM who Edward Ben Williams signed when Allen left. He wanted to get more of a the NFL was kind of moving away from the coach GM responsibility that type of title, which Allen held. He was both the coach and GM during a 7-year period here. So Williams hired Pardee, and he hired Bobby Bethard, who had also proven himself previously with the Miami Dolphins. He was part of the front office of that great 72 Dolphins team that finished 17-0, beating the Redskins in Super Bowl VII. So he was already a proven mind, and he came on at that time heading into the 78 season.
Mm-hmm. Let's just go back 1 second. I'd be remiss not to discuss this briefly with you. The relationship, George Allen and Sonny Jurgensen, it didn't seem like they had a great relationship. I remember one time Sunday was broadcasting, and he told the story. You know, he and Sam were great storytellers. And he said it was like third and long, maybe third and 16. He looked to the sidelines to see what Allen wanted. He said Allen turned his back on him.
Well, Allen did not appreciate Jurgensen's freelancing. I mean, Jurgensen wanted to have the same sort of offensive production that he had in the 60s. And he, first of all, he loved Vince Lombardi. He just admired him so much. That was the greatest. He has said that so many times over the years, that Lombardi was the greatest coach he ever played for. So, and Lombardi basically let him do what he wanted to do on the field. Allen, being a much more conservative-minded coach, his focus was running the ball. So, and Jurgensen did not really appreciate that at all. But as Bruce Allen told me for the book, his father did not really like Jurgensen's freelancing on the field. But the story about Allen forcing Jurgensen out, I really want to clarify that whole story, because I think a lot of people today don't like George Allen because of what he supposedly did to Sonny Jurgensen. It was really Edward Bennett Williams who told Allen after the 74 season, listen, you can't keep both Kilmer and Jurgensen on the team. They're making too much money at the time. You have to decide. You got to let one of them go. And Williams also knew that that Jurgensen was injury prone. I mean, his body was so brittle at the time, and I think he was approaching. I think he'd already hit 40 years old, so he was just being injured so much. And we remember the Achilles tendon tear that he had in the 72 season that knocked him out for the rest of the year. That was just one injury, but he had the broken collarbone in 71. So he had just so many injuries while Allen was there. Allen knew his body was brittle, but Williams gave Allen the ultimatum: you can't keep both of these guys on the team. We're not going to pay both of them. And so that from what I understand led Allen. He took the next steps to make the decision to have a talk with Jurgensen and say, hey, listen, Sonny, we're not going to re-sign you. Because I think Jurgensen's contract expired May 1st, 1975. So Allen told him, we're just not going to re-sign you. Allen really loved Billy Kilmer. I mean, he just saw Kilmer as an extension of himself on the field. It was
I look at that and I'm saying, I understand that, but Kilmer was just so limited physically. I mean, a tough guy, good leader, give you all he has, but he was limited. And his limitations were Exhibit A in their Super Bowl appearance to Miami. Now, you can if and but all you want, but I do believe if Sonny Jurgensen had been on that field that day, Washington would have won that game.
That you can definitely make that argument. I think that game was it could have been to the Redskins' liking if Jurgensen was there. I don't think the Dolphins were. They certainly did not look like a 17-0 team that day. But there were also some calls that went against the Dolphins in the first half. I think Paul Warfield caught a touchdown. The Dolphins were called for a penalty. Now that happens often in the NFL, as we know, but. That was called back, and I think the Dolphins could have done a little more to dominate that game. But the Redskins were in it till the end. I mean, Gary Apremian, that field goal, which was not, as I write, it wasn't really a block. It hit the helmet of the back of the helmet of the Dolphins center. And Ted Baxter also says over the years, though, that when he was flying through, he did catch a piece of it. But and then Mike Bass returned it for a TD, and then the Redskins were in the game. But if Sonny was on the field, you could definitely make the argument that the Redskins would have won the game if he was at the top of his game, if he was playing the type of game that he played in the 60s. And he also had some very good games with Allen, too. I mean, he had a very good record when he was a starter under Allen. And he also played great in the early in the 72 season when he replaced Kilmer in the third, I believe it was the fourth game of the year against the Eagles. He replaced Kilmer And he had some really good games. They beat the Cardinals by 30 points. They beat the Cowboys in D.C. That was a memorable game. I believe that was a 24-20 game. Jurgensen played really well. So, I mean, if he was at the top of his game, yeah, the Redskins could have won that game. Kilmer just had some really bad luck that game. I mean, one of his passes hit the goalpost, which was at the time on the in the front of the end zone. He had Jerry Smith wide open in the end zone for a touchdown in the second half.
Look, we have a couple minutes before we take another top of the hour break, but I got to ask you, and then we can continue for a few more minutes on the other side. I want you to give out all the information about upcoming books or the current books, how our listeners can purchase them. But we got to talk about the origin, as your research tells you, of the Cowboys and Washington rivalry. At one point, that was the big rivalry in sports. Other than Ali Frazier, I couldn't think of a better rivalry, especially in terms of teams. But the beginning of that rivalry, and I think George Allen may have really got that thing evolved and heated up, because George would always say, I wish I could just come to the 50-yard line and just meet Tom Landry, and we have it out there. And Sam Huff would say, oh, no, you don't want to do that. Tom Landry coached me. He was a tough guy. All right, stay with us. More Mike Richmond. Go back to Mike Richmond. And Mike, here's some information that was sent to me. As I say, we got the best, most knowledgeable sports listeners around. And they were saying in 1964, Washington looked like they were moving in the right direction. They traded for Sonny Jurgensen. Next, they drafted Charlie Taylor, Paul Krause. The next year, 65, they drafted Jerry Smith, Chris Hamburger. Okay, and the team went back-to-back 6-8 seasons under Coach Bill McPeak. Instead of sticking with McPeak, they bring in Allen, okay? And then Allen's three seasons in 66 through 68 was 17-22-3. Okay, but man, they had some horrible draft selections. Can you believe in 66 they drafted Charlie Gogolak, a kicker, in the first round? With Mike Garrett. Mike Garrett, Emerson Boozer. Yep, Emmett Thomas. Okay, and then in 67, they drafted Ray McDonald, who was a bust, and Alan Page and Lim Barney, they were on it. And then in the second round, they selected Spain Musgrove, who I love, great guy, but they picked him over Willie Lanier. So, boy, I'm telling you, that's why I will say that Bobby Bethard added so much to this team. But talk about the origin of the rivalry of Dallas and Washington. We want Dallas. We want Dallas.
Yeah, sure. That rivalry, that actually originated in the 1960s during the Bill McPeak autogram years. The Redskins Cowboys, they played each other twice during the year, and they really had like these shootouts at the OK Corral. I mean, they were 34-31 games, 31-30. They were really, really exciting games, and they were led by Jurgensen at quarterback and those great receivers that we talked about. And the Cowboys had some great players, They picked up Bob Hayes, and Don Meredith was the quarterback, and Bob Lilly, defensive tackle. So they had some great players on their own, and they became one of the premier teams in the NFL at the time. They lost to the Packers in the 66 NFL championship game, and the same thing happened in the Ice Bowl in 67. So they were one of the great teams in the NFL. But that's when the rivalry really first started. However, when Allen came here in 71, he picked it up several notches. He intensified that rivalry. He just really, really despised the Cowboys. He just didn't like their – they even had a quiet image at the time, the cerebral image. He didn't like it. He didn't like Tex Schramm. He thought that Schramm got favoritism from Pete Rozelle. Schramm and Rozelle knew each other from working in the Los Angeles Rams organization together in the 1950s. So he thought the Cowboys got favoritism from Rozelle. Allen knew the Cowboys well from the 60s because his Rams scrimmaged the Cowboys who practiced in Thousand Oaks, California, Southern mm-hmm. California. So the Rams and Cowboys scrimmaged every preseason that year. So he knew the Cowboys organization well, and that's where the spying really, you know, the charges of spying really started, that they were Rams officials that would go to the Cowboys training site and, you know, have their cameras and everything. But Allen just picked it up. He got his players into a feverish pitch every time they would play the Cowboys. And so that's where the, yeah, as we talk about the Redskins-Cowboys rivalry today, that's where it really gained its reputation as one of the fiercest in the NFL. And as I've written over the years, I mean, that level of intensity was really on par. Like, you look at the other leagues, you know, the Celtics-Lakers rivalry and the, you know, Red Sox-Yankees. It was on par with those rivalries as well in terms of being the best in their respective leagues. It was just great theater watching those two teams go at it.
Well, for all my Cowboys,
I also want to say, go ahead. I just want to add that sure. Of all the coaches over the years, of all of Allen's rivals, I mean he had a 500 record against Tom Landry, you know, including his days coaching the Rams. I think he was 10-10 overall against Landry. He had a bit of a losing record against Don Shula, his other great coaching rival, and he had a losing record against Lombardi. But he had a 500 record against against Landry. So, and that story about him, you know, squaring off against Landry in midfield, I don't think that would have ended nicely for Allen. Not only was Landry a former defensive back for the Giants, and a tough guy, he was also a World War II fighter pilot. So he was a really tough guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, and Joe Gibbs, it was said that when Joe Gibbs got off to a really slow start, that Jack Kent Cook wanted Bobby Beathard to bring George Allen back. But, of course, that didn't happen. Yeah.
Right. Well, Jack Kent Cook, yeah, he said, we need to bring George Allen back. And I interviewed his son, John Kent Cook, about this. He said he talked his father out of it. He said it would not have worked out well because of Allen's antagonistic relationship with Edward Bennett Williams, who was still the Redskins president at the time, although Jack Kent Cook had taken over the daily operations because he sold his interest in the Lakers and Los Angeles Kings. There was no, like, that cross-ownership. The NFL had something against it at the time. So, but Jack Kent Cook, and he moved east. He moved to Virginia, so he took over the daily operations. But Edward Bennett Williams still had a large percentage of the team. But John Kent Cook said that would not have worked out very well with Williams and Allen. And also there's the case to be made that at the time with the NFL changing in terms of its, you know, approach to personnel, would it have worked out for Allen, you know, focusing mostly on the veterans instead of the draft? I mean, would that have worked out well for Allen throughout the 80s, you know? Nobody knows at this point.
And then final question, at what point did the Joe Gibbs era kind of run out? People were saying that when the salary cap came in, that was, you know, that could have led to it, or was it a situation where, like anything else, players get old, and it ran its course. But it was a heck of a course, as I said. Back then, I don't know if we realized how good we had it. You're talking 4 Super Bowl appearances, 5 NFC Championship appearances in 9 or 10 seasons.
Right. I mean, they were on par with the 49ers as the best teams in the NFL at the time. They were, I mean, Gibbs, the one constant he had throughout his tenure in Washington, he had the greatest offensive line, arguably the greatest offensive line in NFL history, and a line that they were the first of its kind, the first so-called 300-pound offensive lines. Not everybody who played on that offensive line was 300 pounds, but, I mean, Jacoby was there, and but they were close to it. But that was the one constant he had throughout his tenure, and I think that was a major reason that the Redskins were so good over the years. Now, they also had Richie Pettibone as defensive coordinator. He was a great defensive coordinator, a disciple of Allen, obviously. But that was the concept. But Gibbs was also a very, very innovative offensive mind. You know, he went to the single back, two tight end setup, something that he had learned actually from a little bit from Don Coryell when Gibbs was an assistant under Coryell in San Diego. And he was just a really, really smart offensive mind. He left the defense to Pettibone, and it just took off from there. And they had some really great drafts too that Gibbs played off of, such as this wasn't a Gibbs draft, but the '79 draft that brought Monk and Monte Coleman, Don Warren, and then signing Neil Okowitz as a free agent linebacker that year. They were all constants throughout the Gibbs era. And then the 81 draft, I mean, those great players, Dexter Manley and Charlie Brown, receiver, Mark May, Russ Grimm, Darryl Grant, all those guys. And then signing Joe Jacoby as a free agent that year. I mean, that was they all played an integral role in the success of the Gibbs era. So. And also in Joe Theismann, he had a very, very, very good quarterback. Of the 3 quarterbacks, I would say that won Super Bowls for Gibbs, Theismann, Doug Williams, and Mark Rippon. Theismann was really the best of the 3. I mean, he's been a preliminary nominee for the Hall of Fame. He will never get in the Hall of Fame, but he was up there, and he was, you know, he was MVP 1 year, 83. He was a really, really good quarterback, and Gibbs had him in the prime of his career. All of those elements played a role in Gibbs' tremendous success through the 80s and early 90s. But the point that you made early on that it had run its course, I believe that is something that very much led Gibbs to retire after the 92 season. And you could also say that, and as Gibbs said, he was worn out too. He was, you know, just totally burnt out from all the hours that he was putting in, and he wanted to spend more time with his family. I think that played a role in it as well. But all those factors led to his resignation.
How can our listeners get your work?
My upcoming book, George Allen, A Football Life, will be available, an author signed copy, through my website, www.mikerichmanjournalist.com. And actually, I'm going to have pre-orders available as of tomorrow. So you can make those pre-orders through my website, and you get the author signed copies from me. And there are also copies of 2 of my other books still available, The Redskins Encyclopedia and Joe Gibbs and Enduring Legacy. Those are still available for sale, and those are wonderful books as well. So, the George Allen book, my next literary work, will be available for a pre-order starting Monday, and very, very excited about that book. I felt that I was the person who had to do it, because of the very first question you asked me, you know, what led to my Redskins fanaticism. And it was really the George Allen era. And I lived and died by what happened during that era. Like on a given Sunday, I'd have these major emotional swings, and depending on how well they did. And then, of course, I chose journalism as a career. So, those are where my literary works are available.
Well, Mike Richmond, thanks for joining us. This was great. I know our listeners enjoyed it. And, hey, man, we got to get you back, no question.
Thank you very much, Coach. I really appreciate you having me on, and I love the conversation.
Thank you. And, folks, that was Mike Richmond. On the other side, we're going to talk some hoops. Oh, boy, we're going to go back to the late 70s, 80s, and we're going to go to the St. Anthony's Tonys and one of the pioneers in terms of a big point guard in high school. Who am I talking about? Hey, on the other side, we'll have a visit from Felix Yeoman. Stay with us.
We're trying to bring America together with this one here.
Hope you enjoyed the visit from Mike Richmond. And now let's talk some hoops. And let's bring on a guy who I always really liked his game. I thought he was a tremendously underrated, very underrated player. While at St. Anthony's, Georgetown, he could handle the ball at about 6'6 or 6'7 and was a really good player fundamentally. Hey, as I mentioned, let's go to Felix Yeoman. Felix, welcome, man. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Coach. How you doing?
I'm well. And, man, oh, boy, looking back, and, you know, it's commonplace now to see a guy your size handling the ball. But when you did it for St. Anthony's, not only was that unique, but you guys may have had, all you D.C. high school basketball, DMV historians, that St. Anthony's team, you guys may have been the biggest high school team of all time across the board, or one of, certainly.
No, yeah, I agree. I think that that 74 team, 6'11", Tom Skates, 6'8", Gary Wilson, 6'6", Tyrone Best, 6'6", Greg Slim Saunders, and myself, I would venture to say we were the tallest team in the DMV. I think that because we were so tall, our coach at the time, Bob Greer, was enamored with that size. And that's how he ended up putting me at point guard. I could handle the ball, like you said, but I don't know that that was my natural position, because as you know, I like to get down under the paint and bang. I knocked down a 15-footer, take it from the wing, and try to dunk on you. That's where I was most happy and most comfortable. And I appreciate you pointing out that, I guess as far as ratings go, I was underrated. I've heard that from a lot of coaches. So, you know, it's always good to hear, and I appreciate it.
Well, that looked great on paper, having 2 6'6" guards and then 6'11", 6'8", 6'6", underneath. That looked great on paper. But there had to be some negatives to that in terms of maybe quickness and agility.
Also, I think, I don't know that that was a difficulty. I think that team, let me say that team was 2 years, 74 team, was 2 years after Coach Thompson left. So we were still very much coaching-wise in a transition period. So I don't know that we ever really established an identity for that team and really gelled, because we, in my opinion, you know, we underperformed as a team. But then when these all of us went off to college, everyone did extremely well.
Yes, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah. You look at Greg Slim Saunders, he's in the Hall of Fame up at St. Bonaventure.
Yeah.
And I think he's their all-time leading scorer. I think he overtook Bob Lanier as their all-time leading scorer. Gary Wilson, he came to Gary Wilson, myself, Skates, we all went to Georgetown. Tyrone Best played at UMBC, and Gary later left and played at Coppin State. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty accomplished individually, but I don't know that we had 74 teams yelled as a team.
And no one probably knows more about Coach Thompson. You affectionately refer to him as others will do as Big John, because you played at St. Anthony's, you played at Georgetown. Talk about Coach Thompson, the man, and Coach Thompson, the coach.
Coach Thompson, the man, he was quite a mentor to have. I met Coach Thompson when I was 14 years old, because back then the Catholic schools, as they do now, they started in the ninth grade, was from 9 to 12.
Right.
And the public schools didn't start until 10th grade. You went to junior high school, which I guess they're calling middle school now.
That's right.
And junior high school went up to ninth grade, and high school started at 10th grade. So, when I come in 14 years old, wet behind the ears, I came out of the Catholic grade school system. So when I showed up, no one knew who I was. Coach used to call me the Invisible Man, because he used to lecture players on. He said, okay, you come in here and you count heads and think you're going to play next year. Then all of a sudden someone else shows up and takes your spot. So you better be working all summer. I remember he used to give us that lecture all the time. So he saw himself as an educator, and he actually performed in that role in terms of giving you advice, giving you, advice for life, and tried to expose us to as many things as possible. That's why we used to go out and play tournaments in different places, get us out of the city, just to give us some exposure. And he used to share his experiences with us, that his experience from Providence, from college. He used to share his experience with us from the Celtics and playing under Red Auerbach. And so he was all about you making sure that you advance your future, get educated. They talk about the deflated basketball that he had on the desk at Georgetown. And he was very, very, very serious about that. And that's why he hired an academic coordinator to make sure we were doing everything we did in college. Now, as a coach, very stern, very strict. I remember in high school, he would run you. I mean, you make a mistake, he would run you until your tongue would hang out. I remember one practice, one of our players, one of the guys, we were running sprints, and one of the guys stopped in the middle of the sprint, walked over to Big John and said, "Coach, I swear, I can't run anymore. I swear, I can't run anymore." And so he stopped practice and let us go home. But he was always one thing about Coach, and I don't know that anyone really focuses on this, but he had the opportunity to learn and be engaged with some of the most brilliant minds in basketball. If you think about, he played under Red Auerbach.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in college he played under, I want to say he played under Dave Gavitt, who started the Big East.
Yes.
Or he had a strong relationship with Dave Gavitt. And in the Olympics, in 76, he was the assistant coach under Dean Smith. So in terms of his exposure to basketball and some of the greatest coaches in the game. He had
he was there. Yes, he was. Yes.
Yeah, he brought that to the table.
And, man, on a previous guest, we talked about the rivalry at the professional level of the Cowboys in Washington. But when you were in school, you guys had a rivalry, but it never really occurred with DeMatha. Talk about that. And look, man, I was in the middle of it because as a youngster, young coach,
right.
Coach Thompson was a mentor and friend. Coach Wooten was a mentor and friend. So when right. that discussion came up, I just got out of it because I really loved and respected both of them. But, man, I remember that infamous Jelliff game. But talk about that. DeMatha, right. St. Anthony's. And if the game had occurred, how do you think, objectively now, how do you think it could have turned out?
Well, let me start off this by saying I can't be objective, Coach. I'm sorry.
Okay. I respect that.
But that occurred the summer before, just before I got to St. Anthony. And that game had been hyped up. Oh, that would have been an amazing game, Coach. I really do think so. That would have been an amazing game. Because St. Anthony's had Merlin Wilson, Greg Brooks, Jonathan Smith. And Merlin and Jonathan at the end of that year were first-team All-Met. Greg was third-team All-Met, just to show you the type of talent they had on that team. And, of course, they had Cheese Holloway, who was – an absolutely amazing point guard. He's he's pretty legendary around the city.
Absolutely.
And DeMatha had Adrian Dantley, who incidentally grew up in my neighborhood. Went to my local junior high school. Bill Langlow.
Carl Holmes.
Yes, who was
Kenny Roy.
Kenny Roy. Yes. They had a pretty amazing team. I think the year before and you may know better than I do, Coach. I think the year before DeMatha had only lost one game, is that going
well
I think it's
well yeah seven. Well yeah, yeah. And they hold it right there.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a short pause. Stay with us and more to come. Talking Hoops with Felix Yeoman. Go back to our newsmaker line, talking hoops with Felix Yeoman. And, Felix, that was the game or games that we all wanted to see but never saw it. Never saw St. Anthony's and DeMatha. And it would have been a great game because on paper, DeMatha was small. You know, Adrian at 6'5", Carl Holmes 6'3", Langlo 6'3". But anyone who knows, Adrian played so much bigger at the NBA level, at the collegiate level, at the high school level, and listed as 6'5", man. I mean, he could just destroy players 6'9", 6'10". And, of course, Carol Holmes was one of the best rebounders at 6'3". And then, of course, what you guys had, man, it would have been a matchup. And it's so unfortunate that due to politics and a power struggle, it never occurred.
Yeah, that is correct. That is correct.
Because, mm-hmm.
Yeah, as we're saying, you know, both of those teams were amazing teams. As you indicated, you know, the Master was undersized, but Adrian, I remember Kareem Abdul-Jabbar marveling over how Adrian could control the paint at his size and send some of those guys 6'8", 6'9", flying out of the paint, you know, mm-hmm. with his strength. So they did play big, and they played well. They played well together. Coach Wooten was a great coach. But as I kind of indicated before, you know, I have a hard time being objective because I played with those guys and I saw what they did. I mean, that 72 team was 25-1. And the one person I left off the starting five was Dane Edley, who was the shooter.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, you had Cheese at the point. It was a three-guard offense. Had Johnson on the other side, Dana on the other wing, and you had Merlin and Greg Brooks. And Brooks was, you know, he was strong. He was a brute. He was a rebounder in terms of controlling the paint. So would have been interesting to see. But, you know, I respected that the Master team immensely. And respected what they accomplished through that era, and you know they still continue to perform even today.
Mm-hmm. You go to Georgetown. At what point did you realize that either during my tenure or afterwards that this could be a national program and compete and win for a national championship? Did you ever envision that when you were there?
Absolutely. I'll tell you a story, Coach.
Please do.
When I was recruited as a freshman, and by the way, my story was a little different because when I was at St. Anthony's, I started there in the ninth grade. And by the time I got to my junior year, I was pretty academically advanced, and I only needed one class to graduate. And Coach Thompson got wind of that and offered me a scholarship. So I actually left after my junior year, which, you know, looking back on it now, you wonder what additional legacy I could have left as a high school player or could have accomplished as a high school player because, you know, as a high school player, most guys, their goal was to get all met. So instead of coming out with guys like Stacey Robinson, Anthony Cricket Williams, Turk Tillman, Brian Maggot, I came out with the year that Kenny Carr came out, Slim Joyner, Tyrone Jones, and those guys. But when I got to Georgetown, and we had a strong belief in Coach. We had a good group recruiting class. We had myself. We had Derek Jackson from Wheaton, Illinois. We had Ed Hopkins, 6'9 center from Baltimore. We had a junior college transfer from Texas named Billy Thomas. We had Craig Eschrick, who was actually all met at Springbrook.
Oh yeah,
yeah. The Craig and Craig was a shooter, and hopefully I got everyone covered. Yeah, so we brought in a strong recruiting class that year, and I was walking across the parking lot as a freshman. Like I said, I left school early. I was 17 years old, you know, not naive and didn't know what I didn't know. And I ran into the athletic director, who at the time was Frank Rienzo. And he said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm doing great. You know, I'm excited." He said, "Why is that?" I said, "We're going to the NCAA tournament this year." And he just kind of looked at me. "Oh, okay. You know, it's good to meet you." And Rienzo told that story several times at different banquets that I ran into him that year, you know, early on, and predicted we would go to the NCAA tournament. And he said, you know, what kind of nut jobs is Coach Thompson recruiting now? Because Georgetown at that point, I mean, 3 years prior to that, they were 3-23. They were 12-14. After that, 13-13, and then I came in, or that freshman crew came in. And so they hadn't been to the NCAA tournament in decades. And as it turned out, that year we won the ECAC tournament, and we were Big John's first NCAA tournament team. So I did see that. And as we progressed and we got better players, for example, Al Dutch was a huge get. I would have graduated from high school with Al Dutch had I stayed.
But he was player of the year. He was player of the year locally.
That's right, and a Parade All-American. So Al was Coach Thompson's first Parade All-American that did not attend St. Anthony's High School, you know, like Merlin Wilson or Jonathan, you know, or Hughes. So that was a big gift, and that kind of let other folks know that, okay, these guys are up and coming. I don't have any problem going to school there. So as we got Al, we got other All-Americans, Bebe Doran, John Bebe Doran, you know, Craig Big Sky Shelton, you could see it coming. And I remember my senior year, and I knew how driven Coach was. We'd be in practice, and he brought a play, and someone, you know, go off script and do something stupid. And I distinctly remember him blowing the whistle and said, look, let me tell you guys something. I'm going to win a national championship. He said, you can either be here or not be here, but I am going to win a national championship. So this is your only opportunity because you'll be gone after this. So, you know, you guys better straighten up. So we saw how driven Coach was. We saw the work he put in. I remember our gym. They used to keep the gym open till like 3 in the morning. Mm. And as a young guy in love with basketball, I'd be sitting around my dorm room at midnight and say, you know, I'm going to go down and put some shots up and, you know, run some sprints or do some ball handling or something. So I'd head down to gym. And it was nothing for me to see Big John come out of the coach's office 12:30, 1 in the morning from watching film. And, you know, he'd wave and he'd just keep going. And he'd be back there the next morning, ready to go. So we saw how driven he was. We saw how we got better every year. So we knew it was coming. We knew it was coming. And, oh, by the way, the one person I left out of my recruiting class, which I could not see how I could, because he was probably he's in a conversation for the greatest defensive player at Georgetown, was Mike Riley. That's right. He had come out of the Navy. He had come out of the Navy, and he was part of that that recruiting class of 1974. And, right. You know, he made a huge difference.
And all right, hold it right there, and I'll carry over for just a couple more minutes. Thank you. All right, on the other side, more from Felix Yeoman. All right, let's go back to our newsmaker line. Felix Yeoman, I want to carry over, take the last minute. Who better than you, and I'm going to definitely get you back to a part two, but who better than you, the epitome of a student athlete, to give advice to parents out there, student athletes, and young student athletes who may be listening? Please give some parting shots.
Well, My emphasis has always been on education. Because a lot of the kids get caught up and just on the basketball end of it and don't necessarily do what they need to do in the classroom. When I went to Georgetown, I was 17 years old and was excited about playing college basketball. And I will make an admission here, Coach, that I was an extremely good student, but I didn't always work hard.
Okay.
And when I got out into, when I graduated, got out into the business world, and when they start talking return on investment, net income, gross income, and those kind of things, I said, you know, all those terms were familiar with me, to me. And had I put the effort in, I would know those things and know exactly what we're talking about. But now I did go back and get an MBA in finance from AU.
Okay.
So my advice would be to work hard in the books, you know, crack those books open, look at them, and get as much out of it as you can. It's just not all about the athletic end of it. It's an opportunity, particularly to earn a scholarship.
Well, Felix Hillman, this has been great. We're going to get you back because you are wealth, and I got to pick your brain next time about the basketball today. We talked about basketball during your era yesteryear, but I got to get your thoughts on the game today. But thank you so much for joining us, man. Much respect as always.
Thanks, Coach. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Look forward to it. All right, folks. Mm-hmm. Felix Hillman. And let's finish up with our information segment. Let's first go to Rev Nation, Lamont Nelson. Can you update us quickly? What's happening with Rev Nation?
Oh, man. So we're getting ready. And once again, thanks for having me, Butch. I'm so excited. We're going to be opening up on May the 22nd. And May the 22nd, we're opening back up our exchange for Rev Nation on May 22nd.
And May 22nd. Right. Mm-hmm. And then thus far, you've had what? People buying shares at a rapid rate, correct?
Yes, we sold 1.6 million shares already.
Mm. Wow. And then, and how can folks, once you open up, how can folks get in contact or get information about purchasing those shares?
So we have two ways now. When the offering goes live, they'll be able to go to a website that's called revitupshares.com, which is REVITUP. Shares, SHARES, .com. They can go there when the IPO goes live. But if they want to pre-register to get the shares before everyone else, they can go to RevNationInc.com and click on Class C shares, and they can register there, and they'll get the chance to get the shares, you know, before it hits the exchange. They'll actually get a chance to get them sooner. So more than likely, they can get them on the 19th and beat the rest before the 22nd.
And this last point, you are doing this because you had stated numerous times, and I'm paraphrasing, you want to create generational wealth within your community, correct?
And that is the goal, to create generational wealth and also give our people the opportunity to invest in something that they can watch grow and prosper. For me, I believe one of the big things behind this, you know, is something for us. Because honestly, we don't really too much have companies like that, where it's something that's actually just for us, to where we all can actually invest in and watch it prosper.
Mm-hmm. And give the contact information out one more time.
You can reach us at RevNationInc.com. You can also reach us at RevitUpShares.com. Or if you want to send an email, which is info@RevNation.net.
Thank you. All right, Lamont, thank you so much, and we'll get you back next week. Next month, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. See you again. Have a great day.
You as well. And now let's go to, one of my favorite people, because she's always being productive in the community with a great service, Joy Bannister from Joyful Signing. Joy, good afternoon, and what's happening?
Hi, Coach. Thank you for this opportunity. As always, we have a busy day at Joyful Signing. We're busy getting ready for a lot of the graduations with some of our clients. We have a couple of performances today at the Vienna Community Center and at MGM National Harbor tonight. And we're gearing up for Folklife Festival with the Smithsonian. Folks can always find us at www.joyfulsigning.com, or they can reach out at 240-585-0280.
Give that number again.
240-585-0280, or they can reach us at www.joyfulsigning.com. We look forward to making all the events around the D.C. nation's capital inclusive and accessible, and assisting to make sure that everyone feels a part of this community.
Always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Coach.
And that was Joyful Signing. And folks, if you have an initiative or business and you want that initiative or business heard on these airways, just call at 202-446-8606. That's 202-446-8606, and we'll take care of you. And speaking of a business or an initiative, hey, again, Fresh Communities Farm of Brandywine. Now, that's 16004 Ashbox Road. That's in Brandywine, Maryland. It's a farmer's market, and it's open on Fridays and Saturdays from 11 to 5, and it's a great place to get locally grown produce. Again, Fresh Communities Farmer's Market. Folks, I tell you, what a show. I know you enjoyed it. We had early on Mike Richmond, and he broke it down talking about the history of Washington football, burgundy, and gold. Then we followed up with Felix Yeoman, and we talked some old school 70s basketball with Felix Yeoman. And I tell you, just please, for all of you sports fans, tell a neighbor, tell a friend about the show, because we will continue to keep our finger on the pulse and be your eyes and ears in the DMV to let you know what's going on. Sad news, breaking news, Vida Blue, former great pitcher for the Athletics, Vida Blue has transitioned. And you, this is breaking news about maybe 30 minutes ago. And so, yeah, thoughts and prayers with Vida Blue Soul and his family. And what a show, as I said before. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, I promise you next Sunday, I'll be even better. And if you want your product to be heard on this show, just simply dial 202-446-8606. That's 202-446-8606. We'll work something out, and your name, your brand will be heard by thousands of our listeners here in the DMV. All right, I want to thank Horton's Funeral Service, Historic 19th Street Baptist Church, the DMV, Athletes in Action, Bethesda Blues Jazz Supper Club, Martin's Caterers, the Power Trust, Joyful Signing, Tacoma Station, Fresh Communities Farm of Brandywine, and Rev Nation. And as always, I want to thank my technical producer, Anthony. He's just simply one of the best. And folks, check us out next Sunday. But until then, be good, be blessed, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. Makai, what is my current status?
The coach is out.